Motherless Brooklyn devotes a lot of time to explanation, which may be necessary given the intricacy of the plot, but which turns into a lecture after a while. Randolph played with the bullying dynamism that is Baldwin's finest, strongest note, as Norton places him, plausibly enough, the center of a tale of large-scale malfeasance and personal vice that suggests a variation on Chinatown. That's from A.O. Scott of the New York Times. His review of Motherless Brooklyn, one of five movies we're reviewing this time here on Cinephile. That's right. I always listen to the people out there. You guys are so great to be listening. And as always, I appreciate the support. If you can go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, and review. That's how we keep this thing rolling. I love the fact that clearly people are commenting and we got good numbers there right now. In fact, my new best friend, Scott Spinelli over at MLB Network, even commenting here with the latest comment I see. So I appreciate everybody here chiming in. And like I said, the more you can spread the word, the more it helps us out. And proof positive that I always appreciate what everyone's doing. By the way, Scott mentioned specifically, I really appreciate when he turns me on to a movie like Parasite, which I would have not have seen otherwise. So if you haven't seen Parasite yet, seriously, go check it out. It's a phenomenal movie. But proof of the fact that I pay attention to these, I was in Los Angeles for DAZN on assignment, and wonderful girl named Sarah ran up to me and said, by the way, I just want to tell you I love Cinephile. Of course, I was not there for anything to do with Cinephile, so Sarah made my day. And then we got to talking, and she mentioned the fact that she'd commented previously. And I said, I know who you are. You commented last February. You said you work in the industry. You're not a sportsman, but you found my podcast. She said, yes. So there you go. I pay attention to every single review that comes in, whether it's good or bad, and I've got a long memory for it. So it really means a lot to me. And thank you to Sarah, who's always listening and downloading. And I solicited her advice. I said, what should we do with the podcast? How to make it better? What do you like? What do you don't like? She wants more reviews. Mark Simon wants more reviews. I'm giving you more reviews. Five reviews this time here on the podcast. She also suggested, since she's, she says, I normally skip the Bada Binge. I said, no, I hear that. I know it's kind of hit and miss. So I am going to do one last Bada Binge because Sopranos Con was this weekend. That's right. A Comic Con for Sopranos fans. It was unbelievable. It took place over the last couple of days here in Jersey. So I was able to venture out there yesterday, and I have plenty of stories about meeting many of the cast members and such. But Sarah then mentioned we should do Friends as a potential binge, which unfortunately is not going to happen. I have no interest in watching Friends. But maybe we'll get to Breaking Bad once once the Oscar season is done. Joe, I know I had mentioned via email doing a potential Oscars revisit, but I don't know if we're going to do that here. Should we get production for that? What do you think of that idea?
I love the idea. Let's get production for it, and let's do it. I have a few name suggestions of what we should call the segment, but yes, okay. I think we should redo the Oscars, essentially.
Right. For listeners of the podcast, you remember when Shea Serrano was on, I told Shea, I'm going to steal his idea, which is you go back to the Oscars, whatever year, 1988, and redo them and say, okay, here's who should have won Best Actor, here's who should have won Best Director, etc. So that will be coming soon to Cinephile. But let's get to it. There's lots of movies to talk about here, so let's knock out Motherless Brooklyn, which is the first film on the list. Thanks, as always, to the BFCA, Broadcast Film Critics Association, of which I am a proud member, because they get to send me all these screeners. So, you know, people always ask me, do you get screeners all the time? No, it takes place during award season. So from mid to late October till about mid to late January is when I get inundated. It's phenomenal. Ben Lyons, of course, my man who hooked me up with this. By the way, Ben and I, while I was in L.A., I saw Ben and Max Bredos went and saw Uncut Gems, Adam Sandler's new movie, and a Q&A with Adam Sandler. But I think I'll save that story for when the movie, closer to when the movie comes out. Uncut Gems is coming out in late December. So I will tell my Adam Sandler story and my review of that movie a little bit later on. But thanks to Ben for the BFCA, because the BFCA are the ones that sent me my edition of Motherless Brooklyn. And in addition to that, the CD and a record as well. I don't have a record player, but if anybody wants a record, go ahead, have at it. Bottom line is this. I read the book. I love the book, as has my friend and producer Joe. So Joe and I are both big fans of the book, want to see what the movie's all about. And bottom line is this. It helps if you've read the book. I mean, but the book is exceptional. The story is this. It's from Jonathan Lethem. It's about a detective who's got Tourette's. And so the way it's written is so skillfully done is that, you know, he's trying to have a conversation with somebody and then all of a sudden he has these spasms and, you know, these words come out and sometimes it's embarrassing. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's silly. But at all times, it's a little bit unnerving, especially if you don't know who this guy is. The first time you meet him, all of a sudden he spits out some words, goes, I'm sorry, I have these tics. And the fact that Edward Norton shifts it from the 1990s where the story was set, book came out in 1999. My boy Cab, I stole it off his bookshelf. I don't know if he's still read it yet, but it was a great book. And he shifts it to the 1950s, I think, because Norton just loves that area and he just loves that terrain. So he just, you know, he wants to wear a fedora. Great jazz soundtrack. Wynton Marsalis was involved. The great Dick Pope shot it. So he just likes that era, I think. And so he shifts it to the 1950s. So it feels like, you know, one of those private detective movies and those film noirs of the 50s. But the book was actually set in the late 90s. But yeah, detective with Tourette's. How does he manage that? And why exactly is he a detective? He has Tourette's. Like, how does this impact things? But Bruce Willis, his boss, and what a welcome sight to see Bruce Willis in the movie. Don't see him nearly enough these days, playing Frank Minna, his boss. He loves the fact that this character of Lionel never forgets anything. He's got an incredible memory. So, of course, perfect for detective work. He has an incredible memory, but he is obviously memorable, which doesn't help. So it can't exactly be a private detective because people are going to remember, hey, who is that guy? And obviously now we know it's Tourette's, but in the 50s, they just say he has that condition. At times, it reminded me of the great film, Memento, because every single time Lenny goes to talk to somebody, the first words he always says, I have this condition. He has to explain the fact he has short-term memory loss. And so in the case of Motherless Brooklyn, every single time Lionel meets somebody, whenever the ticks come up, he goes, I'm sorry, I got this condition, and away we go. But the bottom line is this. He's clearly after a Chinatown for New York. I mean, that's I read that briefly, that part from A.O. Scott. And I watched Chinatown again recently. God, what a great movie. My buddy Scott Rogowski, it's one of his favorite movies. My friend Anish Shroff, who's really smart, for some reason didn't like it. He thought it was a little bit overrated. I'm like, that's crazy. If you haven't seen Chinatown, go watch it again. And so since I think I'd seen it recently, I was able to see more of the parallels with Motherless Brooklyn. Chinatown is about water and this plot to, you know, keep water away from people and charge people for water. And you've got this horrific villain played by John Huston, who's just an absolute monster. And that famous scene where Nicholson confronts Faye Dunaway and tries to find out, you know, who is this girl? And she says, my sister. And he slaps her viciously. My daughter, slaps her again. My sister, slaps her again. My daughter. I mean, it's just a horrible scene and a big reveal, the fact that Huston is her father, that he raped her, and that woman, that's what she's saying, it's my sister and my daughter, which is just, horrifying revelation in that movie. And by the way, spoiler alert, Chinatown does not end on a happy ending. I mean, that's one of the more darker movies of the 1970s, but it's a brilliant film from Roman Polanski. That ending is just harrowing. Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. So this time in Motherless Brooklyn, rather than a plot about water supply in Los Angeles, this is about real estate. And, you know, focusing on neighborhoods being destroyed here by Robert Moses' New York. And Robert Moses is a real-time character. And if you read Robert Caro's The Power Broker, I think it tells you all about him. And so in the book, in the movie, it's Moses Randolph. So you keep the Moses, pretty clearly who Edward Norton is tipping his hand to. And it's played with perfection by Alec Baldwin, who is just so good at playing these types of villains. You know, he's arrogant and cruel, and but at the same time, very dastardly and very, very smart. So the first thing is Norton's performance. I mean, it's a full diet of tics, mannerisms, jerks, blurts. I mean, I thought he did a really good job with it. You really have to be a strong actor and be willing to be up to the challenge to do it. And I think he convincingly portrayed somebody who has Tourette. So that's first and foremost. And the whole cast is really good. I mentioned Baldwin, but so is Willem Dafoe. He's always must-see TV. He's got a very pivotal role as Alec Baldwin's brother in the movie. And you've got, you know, just perfect casting thing across the board. Like I mentioned, Dick Pope, who also shot Mr. Turner, does an excellent job. The whole look of it is really good. So why is the movie not better? Why am I only giving it 3 Maple Leafs, which is a recommendation, but it's not a rave recommendation. The reason is that in this case, Norton is the director, and this really is a passion project, okay? He wrote it, so he adapted the screenplay from Jonathan Lethem. He directed it, he stars in it, and he co-produces it. But he violates the most important rule of storytelling, which is show, don't tell. And too often, I think, in the second half, it really bogs down when you get characters going on and on, explaining what the plot is, explaining what these machinations are, explaining what the capitalists are doing and how greedy it is. And just as a film viewer, you just don't want to see people just talking, explaining stuff. You're going to actually see it. So that's why I think in many ways it's a bumpy ride at times, a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, it really does attempt to do big things, and I can appreciate the ambitiousness of the movie. But ultimately, for me, it's a, you know, I don't want to say a slight disappointment because I do recommend the movie. But it's 2.5 hours, and ultimately, it's a lumbering film. Joe and I both give this one 3 Maple Leafs. Joe, your thoughts on Motherless Brooklyn?
You know, I can't agree with you more on this. I really overall enjoyed it. And just to talk about the book again, the book is incredible. Anyone who hasn't read it before, definitely put that on your must read. First, I'll say, it's easy to forget with Alec Baldwin doing so much TV and being on Saturday Night Live that he is a movie star and can command the screen and has star power behind him. So it was nice to see him as the villain in this movie. At the same time, it was, I'm not going to say slow, but it just didn't move at the pace that I wanted it to. So at times I found myself wandering.
Justin Chang, who's a great critic for LA Times, he said if Baldwin's bellicose performance reminds you of a certain former Manhattan real estate titan with a history of bigoted practices, even better. And he supports the fact he moved it to the 50s. Norton's boldest, most admirably offbeat stroke was to move the story's contemporary setting to the 50s, the better to accommodate the character's fast-talking noir patois and to clothe some of the actors in attractive period knitwear. It also serves as a useful reminder to the audience that gentrification and discrimination, never far removed from present-day headlines, have deep historical roots. So that was a risky move there by Norton. I think it ended up working out. But I'm with you. I just think at times, you do have a good action sequence and a fire escape. I did appreciate the fact he was going for something different there. But ultimately, it does not leap off the page. Ultimately, all of you, if you have not read Motherless Brooklyn, you should read the book. And then if you want to check out the film, go for it and have at it. All right, next film to review right now is Long Shot, which is from Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. And this story is pretty out there. Charlize Theron plays the Secretary of State, and Seth Rogen is a guy from her past. She used to babysit him. He's now a far left-wing writer, and they happen to meet conveniently enough at a party and get to talking a little bit, charming each other. And then she basically suggests that he work for her because he's such a good writer and that he can punch up some of her speeches because they could use some more humor and some humanity. And very early on, she meets the president, who is, of course, hilariously played by Bob Odenkirk, who tells her that he's leaving because he wants to go try his hand at movies. And that's why now she has an opening to run for president. So the movie never really makes it clear what side she's on. I mean, I guess you could say she's a centrist. But obviously, Rogen is a very far-left guy. The first scene of the movie, he seemed trying to infiltrate the KKK. And he's, saying, death to Jews and stuff and being very self-loathing because he himself obviously is Jewish and eventually escapes. The fact he escapes is actually a pretty remarkable scene. I was shocked at what he did. It's a laugh out loud moment. But that's the basic premise of it. You know, it's a comedy and certainly it's has its moments. But I do think this one, again, is a bit of a mixed bag. This is from Manola Dargis, the New York Times. Theron, a natural screen presence who has developed into an undeniable one, is wonderful in Long Shot. She's a fascinating performer with a watchfulness that can make her seem detached. She seems supremely and confidently alone on screen, which in moments can create an internal tension with her physical superfluidity, her outward inviting flow. It's an ideal combination for this character. And so you got Charlotte and Fred. And by the way, his character's name is Fred. I believe it's like Flutarski. Yeah, Fred Flarski. So he actually sounds like it's supposed to be like Fred Flintstone. And Chris Nashawaty, who Joe knows, he's a terrific film critic, formerly of Entertainment Weekly. His review was so classic. You know, some of these writers, they write so well. He said, not that there's a ton of competition, but Long Shot may be the most deliriously raunchy comedy with a pivotal semen gag since There's Something About Mary. And so you've got Rogen as this apoplectic idealist, you know, a schlubby stoner Fred Flintstone in cargo pants, and then you put him together with Theron's character. So this is obviously the whole fish out of water tale, right? He obviously doesn't belong. She's very much a part of the cavalry. And how are they going to get together? And at first you say, hang on a second. In what world is Charlize Theron going to be linked up with Seth Rogen? Like, are you kidding me? He's, like I said, the schlubby, loud guy. He's smoking weed all the time, doing drugs. And she's obviously beautiful, statuesque, very smart. So it already takes a leap of faith that these two are even going to get in bed together, which inevitably is going to come. Dan Sterling and Liz Hannah write the script. But if you're willing to have that suspension of disbelief, I think it's amiable enough. There's certainly some profane punchlines. Again, I agree with Manola Dargis' review of Theron. She's excellent. I mean, talk about an actress who can do everything. She won an Academy Award for Monster, a serious dramatic role. She's phenomenal in Mad Max Fury Road, a great action movie. And here she is in a comedy. You know, there's one scene in particular where she's trying to negotiate a truce, and she just took a molly with Rogen. They're out partying. And the fact that, you know, she's not overplaying the fact she's clearly high and that her and Rogen just took drugs, but it's really skillful acting there. It made me think actually of Leo when he's on the Quaaludes in Wolf of Wall Street. It's hard for actors to play off when you're on drugs because you got to do it funny. You got to be a little bit loopy, but you can't be overboard with it. So it's definitely, I would siphon it under the outrageous adult comedy. Particularly the first half I thought was pretty good because it's, you know, wild and exuberant. But again, the only way you ever believe these two are together is like, you know, in a TV show like King of Queens. Remember when I met Kevin James, I didn't want to be too rude to him. I'm like, dude, seriously, Leah Remini? Like, how did your character get her? And he's like, no, you see it all the time in Queens. I'm like, yeah, sure you do. But ultimately, I think if you like Rogen, if you like Theron, if you like a good comedy, I would recommend it. I will give it 2.5 Maple Leafs because of the fact it's so rare to see big screen comedies these days. And at least they're going for some good punches. They're trying to be as satirical as possible. Obviously, the world of politics right now, which is so bizarre as it is. But yeah, I think it's enjoyable for what it is. I mean, like I said, with Rogan's character, he's trying to get her to loosen up and do different things. And I think that Theron certainly is really good. I mean, I said her screen presence carries a lot of things. Also of note is O'Shea Jackson Jr. That's right, Ice Cube's kid. He plays Fred's best friend. The best friend role is always a little bit ridiculous. It always feels like something they just kind of patched together. But he actually is pretty funny. And the rest of the cast, Alexander Skarsgård plays a Justin Trudeau-esque prime minister. So he's got the Canadian accent, really warping his vowels over the top, of course. Andy Serkis is in the movie. He plays a Rupert Murdoch-style baron. They've got a whole crew making fun of Fox and Friends. They're like a Greek chorus for the movie. One more thought here from Justin Chang, by the way. Longshot is a bit like watching Hillary Clinton and a Bernie bro fall in love, except you might take that as a warning rather than a recommendation. But it just shows how weird the world is right now, man. That you say, okay, fine. Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen can hook up. Yeah, okay, whatever. Fine. This is the way the world is. Honestly, if you like political comedies like Dave or The American President from the 90s, maybe that'll be something, again, more up your alley. But like I said, it's a likable romantic comedy. I will say the ending, it gets very raunchy. I mean, that's where I thought, hang on a second. Did Rogan punch up this script? Because this feels something more like him or Apatow or Franco might put together. But it gets a little filthy there towards the end. So, yeah, it's not exactly for families. But it is an amusing comedy. I will give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. What's also amusing here is, Joe, you heard the movie was terrible.
Yeah, my friend hated it. Just absolutely hated it. And now I'm curious, after hearing you, I feel like I need to see this movie. But my friend's criticism was that Rogan, this was probably his worst performance as an actor. And I don't know how much weight you can put behind that when it's a raunchy comedy.
Yeah, I was about to say, I would say it wasn't a great performance in that he wasn't stretching. I mean, it feels like that same Seth Rogen type. Like I said, schlubby, stoner, smart, loud, obnoxious. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what he does. Like, it's nothing different when you haven't seen Seth Rogen. That's a funny criticism. I will say this, though. Justin Chang also wrote in that the fact that Theron is the latest Hollywood beauty, a list that includes Katherine Heigl, Knocked Up, Amber Heard, Pineapple Express, and Rose Byrne in Neighbors, to suffer the putative indignity of being cast as a plausible love interest for Seth Rogen. Like, I don't think these actors paid too much of an attention to critics, but like, imagine Seth Rogen's like, hey, all right, you're saying the fact I could not get these four women, Charlize Theron, Katherine Heigl, Amber Heard, and Rose Byrne, only in Hollywood, right?
Right, yeah.
Next one I want to talk about is Late Night, and this stars Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson. Again, speaking of comedies, and in this instance, I was surprised because, again, I'd heard good reviews, but I'm going to give it a lukewarm 2-star review. The story is this. Emma Thompson is a master of invective, as Ty Burr wrote in the Boston Globe. The withering observation that cuts people off at the legs, the bon mot that slips like a shiv through the ribs. And she is a late night host who is suffering some ratings problems. That's right. Things are kind of going downhill. She's been around there for a while. And by the way, it just makes you realize how rare it is to see a female talk show host ever. Joan Rivers lasted 7 months, which shows just the magnitude of the problem, the fact that you really can't get anybody who will do this for a variety of time who has been successful. But I would say the character, based a little bit on Letterman and the fact it was like Dave towards the end, wasn't really trying that hard, kind of mailing it in a little bit. So they decide they need a little sprucing up here, and enter Mindy Kaling, who also wrote the script. And it's okay, who's this Indian American who's self-deprecating, who comes in here? And as Catherine says to her at one point, Catherine is Emma Thompson's character, Molly is Mindy Kaling. She says, your earnestness is very hard to be around. Successful people hate their admirers and can't stand being complimented. So you've got Emma Thompson, who is obviously a brilliant actress. She's kind of channeling Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, right? Classy older woman, but sharp and lacerating and cruel. And then you've got Mindy Kaling coming in, who's perky and upbeat, and she's trying to be warm, and she's trying to warm up the host as well and get the show better ratings. Otherwise, it's in danger of being canceled. It's going to be replaced by Ike Barinholtz, who was previously on Cinephile. He's obnoxious as one of these bro comics is coming in. He's being groomed to replace her. By the way, speaking of the supporting cast, John Lithgow, he plays Catherine's dying husband. Good to see him pop up. He's always a talent. And Amy Ryan, who I like a lot, she's Catherine's boss. And as Jake Wilson, who's a film critic, he wrote, Ryan as Catherine's boss suggests a complex history between the two women with a mingled wickedness and a warmth that may make you wonder. So the story I just thought was ultimately too predictable, right? You're trying to make Catherine likable and make the show a big ratings hit, and you're trying to make Molly a successful writer. And I'm sure a lot of this is based on Mindy Kaling's past experience, because when she walks into the room, you know, it's all young white male comics who are the writing staff, and then here she shows up. the brown girl with no previous experience. Nisha Ganatra, by the way, is also the director. I don't think there's anything particularly strong with the directing. It just feels like kind of a, it has a television feel to it. But it's one of those workplace comedies. But ultimately, you know where the story's going. Unless you're a big fan of these actors, I wouldn't recommend it. I think Mindy Kaling is talented, but I think she can do better than this. I appreciate the fact it was, I'm sure, like I said, based on some roots of what she's felt, whether it's in writing for The Office or just navigating Hollywood. And I do think the movie has important statements to make about sexism and the way that women are treated in the business. And Emma Thompson has a couple of really good monologues when she talks about the fact that, you know, how hard it is for an aging woman, and she's a British woman, the fact that it's tough to get work, it's tough to kind of stay relevant. So I do think the movie, its heart is in the right place. And there's a lot of moments that they can stand to it. But ultimately, for a comedy, it's got to be a lot funnier. And, you know, when I'm coming out of there saying, it just feels like another kind of routine workplace comedy. And when I want a workplace comedy, I want Office Space. Well, this isn't anywhere near that. And again, the beats are there. The fact that she's, you know, an Indian American woman who used to work in a chemical plant, you're sticking her together with Catherine, whose humor is that kind of raised eyebrow stuff. Even the, you know, the top of the fact she's willfully out of touch with youth culture, the fact that she's not on social media, I couldn't buy that. I go, how would this host not be a part of social media and still be on the air in today's age? Like when Molly comes in there, she's telling her, oh, you got to get on Instagram, you got to get on Twitter, you got to try this. And I'm like, as if nobody in the room would have recommended this to her prior to now. Like only now, when your ratings have been in decline for a couple of years, you're in danger of being canceled by Amy Ryan's executive. Now you're like, hey, have you thought about social media before? Let's start doing these videos. Like, you know, look at what Jimmy Fallon's doing. Look at what James Corden's doing. So I thought that was a little tough to breathe there at times. I'm going to give this one 2 Maple Leafs. Joe, do you have any thoughts on Late Night from Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson?
I was kind of on the fence of whether to see this or not, and now I'm firmly off the fence, and I probably will not see it.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those, like I said, when I say heart is in the right place, like it's good to have movies like this. Like, I don't think you have a lot of movies featuring women in their 50s who are central characters, or an Indian American woman who writes the script and is also in the key role. So I feel bad bashing it. And I mean, it's amiable enough, but yeah, I'm going to give it 2 Maple Leafs. And for your sake, yes, Joe, I would probably skip it. All right, those are your reviews so far. But how about the latest from Oscar Farhadi, the Persian filmmaker who made a couple of films that's won Academy Award Best Foreign Films? The latest is called Everybody Knows. That review next. More to discuss here before we will get to our Mount Rushmore. And our Mount Rushmore, by the way, is going to be movies based on books in honor of Motherless Brooklyn. So I think that's going to be a pretty good topic here to discuss, because there's definitely a lot to go through here. But we go from a dragon boss there in Emma Thompson's character to a master director in Asghar Farhadi. Now, he is the guy who won Oscars for A Separation, which is absolutely brilliant, and The Salesman, which is equally brilliant. So he's twice won Best Foreign Film. He also made a movie called The Past, which I liked a lot, was pretty good. And now you have this film, Everybody Knows, which played at the Cannes Film Festival last year. God, I'm finally getting around to seeing it. A year and a half, it was so hard to find this movie. And eventually I got to it. But of course, if it had been as well received as his other films, it would have been easily available. Instead, it's a mixed bag for me, unfortunately. It's a little bit underwhelming, and maybe a lot of this is because of the fact that Farhadi is such a good director. This is the first time he's taken his camera outside of Iran, and the story is set for a big wedding in a small town of Spain. And you got Laura, Penelope Cruz's character, who comes from Argentina with her 2 children. Her husband, Alejandro, played by Ricardo Darín, is not able to make the trip. And so you got a big family wedding, and it, you know, the story gets set up here, and not everybody is family. You've got Paco, played by Javier Bardem. He lives in a hotel, sorry, lives in a nearby wine-producing estate. So they're the ones that tend to the vineyards that used to belong to Laura and her family. So you got history now between Laura and Paco. And by the way, Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem are real-life lovers, in case you're curious. And so these two characters, the fact in the movie that they used to be together and not, you go, okay, all right, we got some history here already. And then all of a sudden, there's a disappearance. And the teenage girl, the 16-year-old daughter, Irene, is, all of a sudden, she's gone. And there's a ransom demand that's texted to both Laura and Bia's phones. Bia is Paco's wife, Javier Bardem's wife. So interesting already here. The kidnappers are going with Penelope Cruz, so that's the mom, but then her ex-lover's wife, they're also texting to. So already you say, okay, where's this going with this? And one thing already I didn't like about it, the title is Everybody Knows, and there's at least 3 or 4 times when they mention Everybody Knows. I just always hate when titles are too much on the nose. I'll take it once, like in Goodfellas, where Ray Liotta explains what a Goodfella is, But I don't like when they're using, oh, and now everybody knows. It just feels so portentous to me. And so I never like when the title said aloud by a character more than once. Meantime, the story is about secrets binding and divided people, the destructive power of unspoken grudges, half-buried memories, that kind of thing. And certainly the choreography really good is excellent early on, especially that moment where she's gone. Imagine being at a wedding, I mean, rowdy celebration, all of a sudden it's replaced by frantic desperation. But this is one of those stories that's about, you know, how the past catches up with you. And again, this is a guy who made a movie called The Past. So clearly this is subject matter that Farhadi's interested in. And it's about the consequences of those actions in the past and how they can appear and, you know, haunt you like a ghost. But ultimately, I thought it was, like I said, a disappointment considering how great this director is. I never thought that it added up to the sum of its parts. To me, the story felt a little bit mechanical. I thought A.O. Scott put it well, the New York Times critic. He said, at once it's overplotted and flimsy, a welter of reversals and revelations that don't do so much resolve as collapse. The movie wants to be devastating and is merely satisfying. And certainly when you see Farhadi's work, if you haven't seen A Separation, you watch it, then this whole story builds up to the ending, which is a crescendo. The Salesman has a devastating climax. In this movie, I was watching it. I said, okay, I can kind of see where this is going. There's been a couple of surprises so far, and then the movie ends. So I think the word to describe it is just ultimately unsatisfying. I do think it's well acted, as always. Penelope Cruz in particular is a real standout. Javier Bardem obviously is solid. And I love Ricardo Duran. He was in a movie called The Secret in Their Eyes. That won Best Foreign Film maybe about 12 years ago. Now it was 2009, 2010. But it's a great, great film. It won Best Foreign Film. And Ricardo Duran is the main actor in it. So I was happy to see him in the movie. He plays Penelope Cruz's love interest. But if I were you, I would go see The Secret in Their Eyes rather than go see Everybody Knows. Took me a while to see it, but unfortunately, I'm only going to give this one 2 Maple Leafs. Have you heard of this movie, Joe? Have you heard of Farhadi's work at all, The Salesman, or A Separation?
You know, I'm completely unfamiliar with his work, but it's intriguing. It sounds like this isn't the movie that, if I'm going to explore his catalog, that I should start with.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's always interesting, too, for a foreign filmmaker when he actually finally gets, you know, this is big-time Hollywood stars here, and all of a sudden it's a story which has gone from Farsi to speaking in Spanish. Right, here's his crossover, so to speak. But for me, it didn't work nearly as much as I would have hoped to. So that, unfortunately, is Everybody Knows and my thought on that movie. Meantime, the last one to discuss before we get to the Mount Rushmore, that is The Russian Five, which is the best movie I'm reviewing this week. 3.5 Maple Leafs for this one. It's Joshua Reel's documentary about how 5 Russian hockey players helped revive the fortunes of the Detroit Red Wings. And it's the first half an hour feels like a spy thriller. I mean, when Sergei Fedorov has to try to come to America and defect. I mean, this is the Cold War. This was that communist regime. This is very difficult in the 1990s to leave Russia. And so you've got a very enterprising general manager in Jimmy Devolano in Detroit. And you've got Jim Leitz, who's now a star CEO, but also part of the Red Wings organization, contacting a hockey writer in Detroit who speaks Russian and asking him to go to Russia and pass this message on to Sergei Fedorov and Vladimir Konstantinov that they want them on the hockey team. Meantime, you've got a KGB official sitting right there. So he's going to speak a little bit in Russian to make sure the KGB guy's okay with that and then speak a little bit of English. And hopefully not tip these guys off and have them being stone-faced the fact that, listen, if you want to come, oh, by the way, here you go. And he's literally giving a brochure. Here's, you know, the cars to the Jaguar. Here's a nice downtown condo in Detroit. Here's a bag full of money. This will be yours, boys. You just have to join us at the certain meet and leave at a certain time and hop in a plane. And in the case of Fedorov, he was single, but Konstantinov, hey, you have to leave your wife, leave your kid. It feels like a spy thriller. So the first half of an hour particularly is very appealing because I don't think you have to be a hockey fan to enjoy it. And in terms of celebrity, you got Jeff Daniels, who's a Michigan native, the marquee name. He says early on, the Red Wings have always been a salve for the city of Detroit. But in the 1980s, they were referred to as the Dead Wings. They hadn't won a championship since 1955. And so they had to think outside the box. And Mike Ilitch, the founder of the pizza chain Little Caesars, he cooks up this scheme here with Jimmy Devolano to draft Fedorov the 1989 NHL draft. And they have to deal with the Iron Curtain. So it feels like a spy thriller here. You know, John Le Carre is there trying to get out of the U.S. But eventually he's there. Konstantinov's there. Slava Fetisov's a great defenseman, was already on the New Jersey Devils. They get Vyacheslav Kozlov, who didn't acclimate very well to the States, still speaks Russian, didn't really care, but he was an angry guy and certainly had enough spit and vinegar that he was well acclimated to the North American game. And then Igor Larionov, who they traded for, he was on the San Jose Sharks and were able to make a trade there. They traded Ray Shepard for him. So eventually, it's little by little. Okay, Fedorov has to acclimate. He clearly is a star. Konstantinov's a great defenseman, dirty player, but rough and physical. And all of a sudden now, how do we get to be this really good team? And as Devolano says, you know, eventually we had 5 Russian players. How do you keep them? And the most fascinating part of the documentary is when they show the different style of playing known as keep away. The fact that the American style is, you know, dump and chase, dump the puck in, go bang on the boards, grab the puck. These guys, no, we have the puck. We're not giving it to you. Even Wayne Gretzky, it says of Konstantinov, I hated him. And he says with a smile, that's a compliment because the fact that these guys were so tough to play against. And even Gretzky says Fedorov was one of the most talented players I'd ever seen before. Ultimately, they have these Russian players and they go on to win their first Stanley Cup in 42 years. And they want to go on again the next year. But there's actually some drama to it as well and some real sadness because of the car accident which Vladimir Konstantinov suffers, you know, only days after they win that first championship. And I'm glad the movie delved into that, this limousine accident that seriously hurt him, never played hockey again, thankfully still alive. I mean, near fatal injury. He's okay, but never played hockey again. And then they won the cup the next year. When you get Konstantinov out there on the ice with his friends, I mean, it's an unbelievable moment. Also, the masseur, Sergei Manatsakhanov, he was also really badly injured as well. So Russian 5, I think, works in a lot of ways. If you're a hockey fan, obviously you love it, but I think you appreciate it as a documentary showing the triumph of spirit and perseverance and team building and cooperation, but also, as I mentioned, a spy thriller overcoming what's happening in terms of the political climate in Russia at the time. And then, as I mentioned, some tragedy there at the end as these guys win a Stanley Cup. You finally reach the pinnacle and all of a sudden one of your teammates is fallen, so to speak. So I thought there was a lot that was good to it. The Russian 5, 3.5 Maple Leafs. Joe, is a guy from Minnesota, you gotta like hockey. I'm sure you're into this.
Oh, I'm really, really into this. I'll definitely be checking out this documentary. And it's like what you said, I like documentaries that can tell history through a lens that you might not think would be a catalyst for this overarching climate of that era.
Yeah, check out the Russian 5, try to find that. A couple other comments here, by the way, everybody knows before we get to entertainment news, because Joe had thrown me a couple of blurbs here. Peter Travis of Rolling Stone said, don't hold this against Farhadi. Everybody knows he's capable of doing a lot better. That's very accurate. And Jeffrey M. Anderson of Common Sense Media, this might have been a pretty good kidnapping story, but writer-director Oscar Farhadi goes soft. He slows it down to the point of almost stopping it, emphasizes goopy, over-the-top soap opera. Sadly, that is true. Go watch his other movies instead. Entertainment news. Paramount sitting Noah Hawley to write and direct the Star Trek film. That's right. The Legion TV creator is in talks to write and direct a fourth film in the current J.J. Abrams-launched Star Trek film series, expected to star Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Zoe Saldana, and the rest of the film series principal cast. My brother, of course, a huge Star Trek fan. He's locked in. The last film in the series was directed by Justin Lin. A separate spin-off film to be helmed by Quentin Tarantino is in parallel development. So that's the main reason I want to mention the story is the fact that, yeah, Noah Hawley's writing and directing Star Trek, but Joe, we still may get Tarantino directing one as well.
You know, it would be interesting to see if these come out around the same time or if Tarantino still does it now that Noah Hawley's doing it.
Yeah, it does remain to be seen. We have to hope. By the way, if you listen to the previous Cinephile, Tara Wood was really good talking about Tarantino, his career ambitions. Check out QT8, The First Date, which is available December 3rd. Todd Phillips clearing up those latest Joker sequel rumors. There's no contract, he said. That's right, a confusing moment. We all thought, oh, God, another Joker, which clearly I said, oh, God, because I didn't like the original. But Todd Phillips said he asked for the right to develop a portfolio of DC characters' origin stories. And then Deadline disputed the fact the October 7th meeting ever happened, reporting that no Joker deals were in place with Phillips and his star Joaquin Phoenix. So then Phillips sat down with IndieWire's Eric Cohn following the latest Joker sequel and said, here's the real truth about a sequel. While Joaquin and I have talked about it, and while touring the world with Warner Brothers executives going to Toronto and Venice and other places, of course we're sitting at dinner and they're saying, so have you thought about... But talking about contracts, there's not a contract for us to even write a sequel. We've never approached Joaquin to be in a sequel. Will that happen? Again, I just think the article was anticipatory at best. So that's good news for me. I'm hoping this does not happen because I wasn't crazy about Joker. Joe, have you seen it yet or no?
No, I'm just trying to decide when I want to get punched in the gut for... it might be this weekend, it might be the next weekend, but I feel like from what you've told me, it's just you kind of have to mentally prepare for it.
Yeah, you don't need to be. There's enough things to bog you down in life. You don't need to have Joker to upset you further. Next one here, just because I love Will Arnett, I wanted to mention this. Steph Curry and Will Arnett, they're working together on an NBA-related series, which is in development at Fox, titled The Second Half. Multi-camera comedy has been given a script plus penalty commitment by the network. It's taking a humorous look at a retired NBA player who moves back home to Charlotte, of course, where Curry's from, buys a car wash, and struggles to connect with his father, daughter, ex-girlfriend, and childhood best friend. He starts to realize that when it comes to the game of life, Curry and Arnett will serve as non-writing executive producers. So I don't know if Will Arnett's actually going to have a role in the show, or it's odd if he would just be a non-writing executive producer and then wouldn't actually be acting in it. But anything involving Will Arnett, I'm into, and I'm glad that Fox, which of course was the main network that gave Arrested Development its boost before it moved to Netflix. Glad that Will and Fox are back in business, right?
Totally, yeah. Arnett's great. I really hope that he stars in it. I'll watch anything with him. I love BoJack Horseman, and so this seems like the best partner Curry could ask for with Clay Thompson being injured, so I'm ready for it.
Yeah. By the way, Warriors are just dreadful. Worst team in basketball right now. Oh, it's ugly. Meantime, false alarm, everyone. Days of Our Lives has been renewed for a 56th season on NBC. Unbelievable. Actors, originally the report came out that could be out of work because no new deal had been reached. Instead, a Corday Productions executive told the cast the renewal is happening. Just needed a few I's and T's and needs to be dotted. They'll go on a year-end break, which is apparently always the case, and production will resume in January. 56 years of Days of Our Lives. That is staggering. Joe, if you'd asked me how many years has that soap been around, I would have said maybe 30 and would have thought that was maybe a bit generous. 56? That's unbelievable.
Wow. It's also kind of incredible that we still have a long-running show from the early 60s that still exists in the world. It seems like a throwback to old TV. So, you know, here's to another 56 seasons.
Days of Our Lives. Unbelievable.
Mount Rushmore.
All right, this is a great idea here Joe gave us for the Mount Rushmore of movies based on novels in honor of our featured review of Motherless Brooklyn. As always, you can tweet us, give us your suggestions for what you'd like for the Mount Rushmore, Cinephile Pod, CinePhilePod, or you can tweet me individually, Adnan S. Virk, AdnanSvirk. This is a tough list, man. There's a lot of great movies on this. Oh, my God. I feel like there's no way we can do this properly, but we'll just dive in. Goodfellas for me, absolutes, one of my favorite movies of all time. That's based on Wise Guy by Nicholas Pileggi. The book is great. There's one quote in particular I love in which Pileggi talks about most wise guys who he's talked to are so narcissistic. They can't see the forest for the trees. They're so obsessed with themselves. They don't really understand what's happening outside of their own self-glorification. But in the case of Henry Hill, Henry was all eyes. It's a great expression. And so it's just how fact that Henry was always observing everything. And that's why he was a great collaborator for Pileggi in telling the world of wise guys and what was obviously the template for one of the great films from Scorsese with Goodfellas. So that one absolutely is in there. Now it gets trickier. Like, I'd love to get Cuckoo's Nest in there. My brother told me it was a Jeopardy question recently, but I can't put that in there. I'm putting The Godfather in. Okay, that's a pretty easy one, right? Mario Puzo. Rare example of the movie being better than the book. The book is good, but there's some weird stuff in there. Remember, there's a sequence with this gynecologist was very random. I mean, there's some fluff in there that you feel like you definitely could take out. So credit to Coppola. He actually took a best-selling book, which was beloved, and took out some of the nonsense and just focused on the great stuff and elevated it to perhaps the best film of all time. So Goodfellas and The Godfather, two no-brainers. God, I'd love to get, I'll get Apocalypse Now in there. That's based in Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. Again, having read the novella, I thought, wow, I'm putting two Coppola adaptations. I didn't even realize that as I'm saying this. I'm going to put that in there as well, just because of the fact that it was definitely a challenge to adapt that. And just the fact that, as Coppola said, you know, my film isn't a film about Vietnam. It is Vietnam. There's so many indelible sequences. You know, the Ride of the Valkyries and that whole helicopter assault, Duvall's performance. Love the smell of napalm in the morning. When Brando shows up, yeah, it's a little bit lost and confusing, but he does have a certain mystique about him because he is Brando and he's overweight and he's, you know, cloaked in these robes and he's bald and he's talking about cutting people up. I'm like, oh my God. Martin Sheen, that first sequence set to The Doors, the end. There's a lot of great, great moments in Apocalypse Now. Even if at times you don't really understand where the hell it's going, I do think it's a great war film. And now it gets really tricky. You got to get one of, like, The Maltese Falcon, you know, Kill a Mockingbird, Trainspotting, True Grit, No Country for Old Men. What the hell? I'll go with The Age of Innocence. How about that? Another Scorsese film, just because it's a little bit off the board here. I'm going to go with, you know, a period piece because, again, I read Edith Wharton's novel, and it's really hard to adapt a film of that time to today's era. But Scorsese do it, and one of the smartest things he did was he had a voice of the narrator. So I'm giving him specific credit for the adaptation because he was smart to say, you know what, I want to try to get a sense of the feel. So Joanne Woodward is the narrator, but she's not actually a character in the movie. It's a very unique idea when you have that. Alec Baldwin, of course, did that for the Royal Tenenbaums. Like, I love that idea of having a narrator who's not actually a character in the movie. So because of the fact Marty used a narrator in Age of Innocence in adapting the book to the movie,
which is one of the great stories about unrequited romance ever. And it's just, you know, totally devastating and heartbreaking, and shows his range as a filmmaker that he can make this love story like that. That's my list. Age of Innocence, Apocalypse Now, Goodfellas, The Godfather. I should do a separate list not involving Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola films. But have at it, Joe. You've got a great list here. I'm sure you can have Dr. Zhivago, Brokeback Mountain, Fight Club, Gone with the Wind. There's tons out there.
There's so many. And we were talking beforehand. It's just, how many Harry Potter movies do I want to include? And can I fit a Hunger Games movie in there too? We'll find out. I think, first off, I'm going with American Psycho.
Nice.
Bret Easton Ellis, he's one of my favorite all-time writers. And so American Psycho. So my second one would be No Country for Old Men, Cormac McCarthy. And then my throwback, I'm doing To Kill a Mockingbird for so many reasons. Gregory Peck, I don't really think I need to say any more. But my favorite adaptation that I've ever seen is 1979, The Warriors, based off of Saul Urich's novel of the same name. And it's just about this gang in New York. They're from Coney Island. They go up to the Bronx for this huge gang meeting. Then they get framed for the murder of the head, you know, gang person in New York, and they have to make it back to Coney Island safely through the subway with every gang in New York City chasing them.
Wow, The Warriors.
The Warriors. Have you ever seen it before?
I haven't. I've heard about it. I feel bad now, Joe. I've let you down. The Warriors I haven't seen, and I'm still going to get to Blowout at some point here. Sound Engineer, that's the one that's closest to your heart.
Yeah, that's the one closest to my heart. But this one, if you have 2 hours to kill over Thanksgiving weekend, definitely watch The Warriors. This is my number one recommendation I think I've ever had on Cinephile.
Well, I know Shaquille O'Neal is a big fan. He's quoted The Warriors before, definitely in some rallies and stuff. All right, good list there. Once again, tweet us with your thoughts on your Mount Rushmore. And now it's time, a little special edition here of the Bada Binge.
The Bada Binge.
All right, I know last week it was the final Bada Binge, and that is true, but this is just a special edition of the Bada Binge because I went to Sopranos Con. That's right, a Comic Con for Sopranos fans. It's amazing these guys pulled this off. They had 55 cast members there, but let's clear this up on who was not there. Carmella, Edie Falco, no Christopher, Michael Imperioli, no Meadow, Jimmy Lynn Sigler, no AJ, Robert Eiler, no Annabella Sciorra, Gloria Trullo, no Janice, Ada Turturro. So those are some, you know, big names here. Okay, not there. But look who was there. And by the way, it took place in the Meadowlands. So like it really felt, I mean, I live, you know, 25 minutes away. So it's right near, you know, Giants and Jets Stadium, MetLife as well. So this is taking place on a Saturday and a Sunday. I figured Sunday would be a disaster with all the NFL traffic. But it was so cool being there, man. I mean, you walk in there and you can just, you know, smell the sausage and peppers and the big ziti. And they got cannolis for sale. And it's just a bunch of wannabe wise guys out there. And everyone's just soaking up the ambiance of the show and Italian-American culture. And my wife and I had a blast. I mean, I think she was a little off-put by the crowd. It was working class, to put it politely. But listen, man, we're hardcore fans. We're just up there, and everyone's probably spent their savings for 6 months to come here and attend because it was not cheap. $50 for admission. But I knew, it just like it's like going to a flea market. $50 means you just walk around. Okay, I'm going to go buy a Soprano shirt or a mural of Tony Soprano. Okay, that's 20. This is 20, whatever. No, get whatever the next package is. So I went the VIP package, which was the acting capo. So to get the capo package, it's $150 a piece. So $160 with tax, $100 for the sitter, you know, a little bit of food, $450, which is the same price I paid for the New York Film Festival, if you'll recall, to get opening night tickets for The Irishman and then tickets for 10 other movies, one of which ended up being Motherless Brooklyn, which Joe ended up going to see. So for the same, look at how about this idea? Either you could see The Irishman for the same price, New York Film Festival, and by the way, in attendance were Scorsese, Pacino, De Niro, Pesci, or go to Sopranos Con with your wife, get a sitter, nice 6 hours here in the Meadowlands. It was great, man. Had a total blast. And grateful a few people recognized me. A guy ran up to me, big Cinephile fan, said he listens all the time, said he loved the Bada Binge. So I really appreciate the fact people are listening, and there was a fellow Sopranos fans there. And it was great, man. Like I said, the first couple hours, you kind of just wandering around, checking out stalls, meeting people. I mean, they got guys dressed up as like Artie Bucco. Like, it was unbelievable. It literally is Comic-Con for Sopranos fans. Then they had this Italian singer. He was great. He did this Italian song. They always play at weddings all the time. So I, of course, messaged that to my Italian friends who verified that, yes, we always hear that song at weddings. And the food was great. You know, a little bit of, they didn't have any ziti, but I had to get a chicken cutlet, had a couple of cannolis. And then you have the booth set up. So Here's one of the areas where the creators went wrong, and they were very defensive. I just saw this email they sent to all of us. Like, hey, sorry, I wasn't 100%. Okay, we did our best. Yeah, I know you did your best, but here's where you went wrong. You have general admission people, and they're all lining up to get an autograph or a picture. And what you got to do is it costs you, one box is 80. So it's 20 bucks. So literally, you have all these cast members sitting at these tables. It reminded me vividly of The Wrestler, which is a very sad, despairing film. But the scene where Ram Jam, Mickey Rourke, and all those wrestlers are sitting there, and it's like, all right, they're charging 10 bucks for a picture, 10 bucks for an autograph. Like, it just feels so sad watching that movie. So here with this, it was just my first thought. Like, you get a bunch of actors from like 15, 20 years ago, and some of them have not done anything of note since then. And we're talking like minor characters. They're just sitting there at stalls waiting for someone to go, oh, here's a box of ZD. That was the expression, obviously. Here's 20 bucks. Can you just sign my poster? Can you just take a picture with me? Whatever. But listen, what the hell? I think a lot of them were in a good mood because, hey, you're reveling in the fact you're part of one of the greatest shows of all time. It's nostalgic. And you're giving it back to fans. And that's why nobody was more generous than Drea Di Matteo. Easily, Adriana had the longest line. I mean, I looked, I go, oh my God. Like, it's got to be an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. Like, I said, how could you wait in that line? And she was unbelievable. I noticed a couple of the older actors, Vince Curatola, who plays Johnny Sack, you know, like, give me a 15-minute break, go to the bathroom, whatever, make a phone call. She did not stop. And every single person, big smile, she's hugging people, she's friendly. I mean, she looked great, still a knockout. So props to her, because Drea Di Matteo certainly was the biggest star there. And she was awesome. Second, I would say, would be Uncle June, Dominic Chianese. So my wife and I quickly said, okay, how are we going to do this? Because they have general admission, signings, et cetera. You give a box of ZD. The VIPs, which we were, they said, okay, after 2 o'clock, you can sign. But it was ridiculous. What ended up happening is, and these guys admitted this in the email they sent to all of us, which is that we misread the fact most people got VIPs. So the whole point of getting the VIP is it'll be a shorter line to get a picture or an autograph. And instead, I think the lines were longer. So the other part of it is this. I'm thinking I paid $150. So for each of these people, and I don't care about the autograph. They gave us a big poster. Like, well, I don't care about a scribble. Everyone knows selfies are the new autographs. I just want pictures. And I see there's a very short line for Johnny Boy Barisi, who is Tony Darrow. I mean, it's Larry Boy Barisi. Tony Darrow, he's in The Sopranos. More importantly, he's in Goodfellas. He's the one that tells Pesci to pay the tab in the One of My Funny scene. And then Pesci smacks the bottle of wine over his head. And then later he's pleading with Pauly, you know, to take care of Tommy. And then, he agrees to have Henry run the restaurant. I went up to him. And by the way, he mumbled something. I was like, look at this guy. And I thought he was making fun of me. So literally, I'm like, what did you just say to me? And I said, look at this guy. He's so built. I guess my sweater was a little bit tight, a little bit of a schmedium. So I thought he was calling me fat. But he goes, oh, I'm saying, look at you. You look big. You look strong. I'm like, oh, thanks. Can I get a picture? And his buddy, because they have a handler like at each table. And he's like, oh, it's 20 bucks. Like one box is 80. And right away, I show my label. I go, no, I'm a capo. Look, I got the VIP. He's like, yeah, it's still 20 bucks. I mean, you gotta be kidding me. I paid $150. I gotta pay 20 bucks here for a picture with this guy, Tony Darrow. God love him, who is in like, handful of scenes in The Sopranos. Like, I was like, no, I'm good, thanks. But other people were really nice. Oh, by the way, no Silvio as well, Stevie Van Zandt. But Maureen Van Zandt, his wife, was there. Very short line. So literally, I just walk right up to her. Can I get a picture? Yeah, of course you can. Boom. Knock that out. So my wife is a big fan of Dominic Chianese. So she goes, I will wait in the line for Junior. You go ahead and knock out as many of the other ones as you can. So I'm getting like Robert Funero. He played Eugene Pontecorvo. Remember when he committed suicide? I'm like, that guy's great. I'm like, he was in one pivotal episode. He was awesome. Burt Young. I'm like, I'm definitely getting Burt Young. Couldn't believe Burt Young. Very small line. This guy's freaking Pauly and Rocky. Like, this guy's an acting legend. So I was thrilled to meet Burt Young. 5 minute wait. And I was, of course, put the fist up. Like, here we go, man. Me and Burt. And for those who don't forget, he played Bobby Bacala Sr. And he was a part of one pretty big hit. Also, no Bobby Bacala, Stephen Sharipa. But then you get Lola Guadini. She played Agent Deborah Ciccheroni. Of course, Adriana's the one who gets Adriana, locks her up, obviously. She was great, very friendly. Short line here. Agent Harris is awesome. Matt Servito. The people were getting pictures with him. He was like purposely like, locking him up. So putting your hands behind your back. So I got one with him. He was awesome. Agent Harris, Matt Servito, good sense of humor. I love Jackie Jr. Went up, met him very quickly. Jason Cerrone, nice guy. Sophia Milos, very attractive. Remember the Italian mob boss? Again, charging 20 bucks for a picture. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I'm a VIP. I paid $160 for this. I'm not going to pay you on top of this 20 bucks for a selfie. You look great, but I'm not going to do it. Speaking of the Bada Bing, they also had a Bada Bing original dancer. I mean, I am literally on the floor laughing. Like, it's an actual stripper who was in the show and worked at the Bada Bing, and she's there dressed as a stripper, of course. And I'm like, and these guys, again, working class, truck drivers, mechanics. Hey, look at her. Hey! Like, it was so funny. They're handing over boxes of ZD to get a picture with this weathered stripper. And although in front of all of them, the stalls, they had their pictures from the show. I'm like, yeah, that is definitely her. I do remember that face from The Sopranos. She's not making it up. Bada Bing bartender as well. So anyways, my wife's waiting in the line. I'm getting everybody else. I go back. We meet Chianese. He was great. Of course, my wife loves Godfather like we all do. I mentioned Johnny Ola to him. I just said to him, hey, there's so many great lines as they're taking the picture. He's like, what's your favorite? And I said, Tony's one C hair away from owning North Jersey, and I am that C hair. And he kind of laughed. He was like, oh, I said that. I'm like, of course. You're like, come on. I don't know if he was playing dumb, but he's like, oh, that's a pretty good line. I forgot that. Johnny Sack is great because we live in Hohokus, which is next to Ridgewood, 5 minutes away. And Ridgewood Auto, where I go to get my car service, there's a picture of Vince Curatola in there. And it just says, John, this is a great garage. So I met him. I just said, hey, man, I go to that garage in Ridgewood, John Tashjian. And he's like, oh, yeah, I know John. Yeah, cool. I'm like, oh. He says, you always bring the Benz by. I was like, yeah, yeah. Like, that's all you're getting, right? You get these 10-second moments with these guys. I'm like, all right, I got to talk to Johnny Sack with his Mercedes-Benz. Get a picture. Move it along. But I had a blast, man. My wife was laughing. She said, you're geeking out so hard right now. I ended up beating 16 cast members. And so here were the nicest ones. Catherine Narducci was unbelievable. She ended up talking to me, I swear to God, for like 5 minutes. She's holding up the line, just talking to my wife. Because she was so nice. She was in A Bronx Tale, played De Niro's wife. She's also in The Irishman. She's great, small role, but she's in the back of the car there with Pesci and De Niro when they're making the long drive. And of course, she played Charmaine Bucco. So she was super nice. When I met her, I go, hey, I want to tell you something. I paid $450 to go see The Irishman. She's like, you what? I'm explaining to her. I'm like, I went to the New York Film Festival. I had to get extra tickets. She's like, you're crazy. You're a nut. I'm like, I had to do it. I go, the movie's unbelievable. Because you loved it. I'm like, yeah, of course. I've watched it 3 times in theaters. I'm going to see it again when it comes out on Netflix, November 27th. And my wife already told her, you know, how much crazy we are. So she was really nice. Did not get Big Pussy. Long line for him. So I passed on him. Here's the other two who are super nice. This guy's unbelievable. Mario Polit, who you can follow on Twitter, on Instagram, excuse me, mpolit13. He's trying to get the followers up. I said, sure, I'll tell people. mpolit13. Maybe think of the old Nordiques defense, Michel Petit. I said, I'll remember your name. His poster, he literally has the picture of Employee of the Month behind him. And I'm telling my wife, I go, yeah, that's the guy who raped Melfi. She's like, what? I go, remember the episode where Melfi was raped? That's the guy. And he sees me telling my wife, and she has a look of horror on her face, and he starts waving at us. Like, he waves us over, and I'm dying. He goes, listen, I've been sitting at the stall all day. That's the funniest thing I've seen all day. Your wife's reaction to the fact that when you were telling her who I am. But I said, God, you're unbelievable in the show. He said, yeah, let me tell you something, because we were crying in between takes. He goes, it was such an agonizing scene to do as an actor. And to this day, people are like, oh, you're the guy that raped Melfi. mpolit13. He's also a firefighter, though. I mean, wonderful guy. I talked to him for like 10 minutes. He was so funny. He started talking boxing. I'm like, oh, I'm going to Saudi Arabia, Ruiz Joshua fight. Okay, that's cool. Oh, you're on DAZN. Okay, cool. ESPN, sure, whatever. So he was great. Definitely support his work as Jesus. I think Jesus Rossi was the role. I think that was his character's name. Employee of the Month. Anyways, we all know what a great episode it was. The other guy was unbelievable. Armin Garo. If you remember late in the season, he's the mobster who's part of Phil Leotardo's crew. He tells Meadow, he goes, looks like you have a little bit of whipped cream on your face. God, I'd love to add to it. It's just a filthy thing to say. And then later on when Tony gets word of it, when Meadow's telling Carmela she's cheerleading, he nearly beats this guy to death. That guy's great. He was telling me his backstory. He's Armenian, hence his name is Armin Garo. He's also on Instagram. Find him, A-R-M-E-N-G-A-R-O. Super nice guy. Pictures of me and my wife, family, telling stories, talking about Gandolfini. So I honestly, SopranosCon was a real hit because just like if you went to a football, you know, team, it's okay, 53-man roster, everyone's going to talk to the quarterback, go talk to some of the so-called lesser lights. Same thing with the Sopranos. I mean, we met Tony's other sister. She's great. She was so friendly. We're like, oh, I wish you were in the show more. She's like, yeah, me too. Because you don't know what it's like to be a cast member. You're always hoping to get more lines, more roles. But, you know, it's ultimately up to David Chase and the writers. So she was really cool. Ultimately, just a very cool experience. Like I said, you get to geek out big time. And two stories as we close. One was that Vince Curatola told the story. It was a Q&A, so I actually asked the question. I say, hey, can you tell the story that Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zoller-Seitz told in the Sopranos sessions? By the way, Sepinwall was there. He messaged me after he saw that I tweeted. I'm sorry I didn't get to see Alan there. I've been talking about his book every time on Cinephile for like 6 months now. But yeah, Sepinwall also in the house. So at least him and Matt were able to hopefully sell some books as well. But Curatola told the story when he first got cast as Johnny Sack, and he said that he had to be at somewhere else, like in Long Island. He had to get to the city. And he goes, I was so reluctant to do it. I just didn't care, right? Because I hadn't had much success lately. I'm like, this is a waste of time. I'm not going to do it. He goes, I'm at least 30 minutes late by the time I get to Manhattan. I go get a slice of pizza. I goes, I swear, I'm like feeding dogs, kittens. I'm doing everything I can but go to the audition. He goes, then I stop for a smoke. I have a smoke. He goes, back when I used to smoke, I go upstairs. And the casting director, without looking up, says, you're late. I'm like at least an hour and 10 minutes late. I'm like, whatever. I don't even care. I'm hoping she says, just go home. You're done. Instead, I do it. I get called back the second time. And the second time, because when I'm doing about to do the audition, I hear everybody else going in ahead of me and they're all yelling and shouting. And I said, okay, I'm going to go the other way. So I was very quiet and very subtle in my delivery. And David Chase said, that's why I cast you, because you were different than all the other guys. And the other guy, didn't get to meet him, Little Carmine. He's great. Ray Abruzzo. Ray's story, he said the reason I got the role was the script that I had to read was there was a mention of the Treaty of Versailles. And I was talking about mending fences between the wise guys. And I just said, okay, you know, this mobster, I don't think he's that smart. I'm going to say Treaty of Versailles. And again, David Chase goes, you're the only guy that purposely mispronounced Treaty of Versailles as Treaty of Versailles. And that's why you got the role. So pretty cool, man. For all those actors out there, take chances, take risks, make it your own. And maybe one day you can be a part of the greatest show of all time. The Sopranos. Sopranos Con, Joe. What a concept taking place in the Meadowlands.
I absolutely love it. And they can't pick a better location for the Sopranos Con as well. I don't know what I would have done if I had met Junior Soprano. Honestly, I'm surprised that you were able to keep it together in front of him.
Well, our friend Michael Lombardi, of course, could quote Uncle Junior all day long. But do you agree with my tactics? Like, I thought of all the names. Like, I'm telling you, the Adriana line was seriously, it was ridiculous. Yeah. I said, okay, you're gonna spend 2 hours. By the way, the VIP was literally from 2 until 4, and they were all gone. And I'm telling you right now, either you had to make the choice and say, okay, it's Adriana or bust, or let me get everybody else. And we still got Junior, which I think is pretty epic.
Right, exactly. It kind of reminds me of like going to an amusement park, and it's like, all right, I can go for the most popular ride, or I could get a bunch of other rides in that same time it would take to wait. So that's really, really cool to hear as well.
It's awesome. Once again, check out my Instagram, Adnan Svirk, Adnan Svirk. I posted all the pictures of all the cast members that I got to meet, so you can check that out there. And that's the last we'll talk about the Bada Binge and the Sopranos, I'm sure, for a little bit. But as always, I could talk about it all day long. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate all of you. This was a long one. A lot of talking here from me. That's why we went no guest. But Juwan reviews, Sarah, Simon, we gave it to you. 5 movie reviews. Next week, because these screeners keep coming fast and furious, I'm looking at my desk right now. I got the 2 Popes. We'll review that. Jonathan Pryce, Anthony Hopkins, both getting Oscar buzz. New film directed by Fernando Morales. He's the guy who did City of God. Brilliant movie. And we'll also review Wonderful Day in the Neighborhood. That's right. Or is it A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood? Whatever the hell it is. Tom Hanks' new movie, Playing Mr. Rogers. Just got that screener as well. So next week, we'll be reviewing those films and much more here on Cinephile. As always, do subscribe, rate, and review. And I'll see you at the movies.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.